Good morning, brothers and sisters. Well, we left off yesterday, somewhere around this point here, about mercy triumphing over judgment. And just to catch us up as to where we're at when you start looking at what James is after. It's always good to go back and retract, so you go back and have a look and review. James was trying to get us to understand that God is involved in every aspect of our life. And if you really believe that, then God can work in your life, because when angels then bring circumstances into our life, instead of just treating them as random chance events, we will then start to look at, well, what is God trying to help me understand now? What is he trying to teach us? What are we supposed to be learning from this? With the understanding that he's not trying to destroy us, he's not trying to get us to sin, he's trying to shape us into blocks now that will slide right into his building in the age to come. And he's basically just trying to conform us to the image of Christ. So then what James has to do is, because our brains so easily deceive us to where we think we are better than we are, and that is really his real problem that he's dealing with here, is we deceive ourselves. He said three times in chapter 1, don't be deceived. Because he realizes how easy it is for us to fool ourselves of thinking of ourselves as better than we really are. So he wants to give us some very specific cases. This is why the letter of James is, in our Christadelphian community, we all know it's very practical. You hear somebody's going to do classes on James and you think, oh good, this isn't going to be theory, this isn't going to be analytical, this is going to be very practical way of life issues that we can use, because James then gives us real clear little tests to find out, is the truth making an impact in your life? Is faith really changing the way you live? Or do you just have a belief system that we call our faith, but it doesn't translate into changing our life? That's really what James is after here. He wants folks to learn that this belief system that we have, the Christadelphian doctrines, the statement of faith that we go over, when we have our baptismal interviews and we answer all those questions, that is supposed to change the way we live. That's not just a club to belong to. This is going to be a way of life where we pattern ourselves after the example of Christ. And so he gave us in chapter 1 the mirror test, that we look in the mirror. We don't want to be like people who just read the word, close the Bible, and go away and totally forget what we were supposed to work on. Now, you know we can do that. We can do the readings at home. We can do the daily readings. We can check them off. And we can do all three of them. And we can get them done really fast, close our Bibles, and get right back to work. And when we do that, we have failed the mirror test, because the mirror test was designed to help us look into the mirror and find out what are we really like and what do we need to work on and meditate on those things and ask for God's help. So then in chapter 2, then he goes on and has a look at this issue of prejudice, because James knew this was another clear case to figure out, how are we doing on letting the Word of God, the implanted Word, change our brains? Our brains are naturally prejudiced. We look at each other and we make judgments about each other based on what we wear, how we talk, what we drive, what kind of stuff we have with us, how we raise our children or what our kids are doing. I mean, we do this. We look at other people's children. We watch what they do and we make judgments about the parents. And we do this kind of stuff all the time. This is just the way we have been created. That is the natural mind. And what James wants us to do is realize that, wait a minute, that's not the way it should be. Those things shouldn't be so. So he's going to give us today, we're going to finish off with looking at Rahab and Abraham, on people who had works of faith. And then chapter 3 is all about the tongue, looking at how if the truth is really having an impact in your life and the implanted word really is in there and it's changing your brain and the way it sees life and it's turning us into children of God, then our tongue will get under control. We won't say the things we used to say. We won't react the way we used to react. And so James just throws these things out there, and it's basically he's saying, here's the way it should be, and then he leaves us to consider, well, how are you doing? How am I doing on this? So that he gives us a measurement tool. He's giving us something like a pH scale or giving us like a thermometer, so that we don't deceive ourselves, but that we can really look in the mirror and find out, how are we doing on controlling our tongues? How are we doing on showing works of faith? How are we doing on not showing partiality and favoritism in our community? Are we really living like God? So that's what James is after here, and we'll pick it up somewhere around, we're in chapter 2, right around verse 14. We ended up yesterday with this section about mercy triumphing over judgment, and I really think that, you know, that is one of those Bible verses you box in and you realize that this is where it's at. In the end, out of all this favoritism and all this judging that we can do in this life where we judge and we judge, James lets us with the bottom line. He leaves it off of speak and so do in verse 12 as those who we judge by the law of liberty. And all really encouraging us to realize that when it comes time to working with other people's children and other members of ecclesial life, let's treat them the way we would like to be treated and realize that in the end that mercy will triumph over judgment. It's very easy in ecclesial life, and it's very simple in family life to make judgments on other people and condemn. But the greatest thing that a person in power can ever do is choose to show mercy. It shows the ultimate of what God's character is all about. And we're looking at here, this isn't just general mercy, and this isn't just overlooking sin. He's dealing with the fact that there are going to be cases in life where people make mistakes. And therefore, what do? These aren't rebels. These aren't people that are just outright, you know, disobeying the truth. They're just mistakes that are made. And people come back to us and they say, I goofed. I've made a mistake. I'm sorry. And what are we going to do at that point? We're just going to grind them into the ground, you know, keep pushing on them until they come back and they just, you know, call for mercy? Or are we going to treat them like we would treat our own children and let mercy triumph over judgment? So he goes on in chapter 2 at verse 14 now and says, look at, what does it profit, brethren, if somebody says he has faith, but he doesn't have works? Can that faith save him? His faith, that kind of a faith, can that actually save him? Now, I guess I threw in here, I was going to throw you one other example about mercy. I'd totally forgotten about this one about Joseph. I think it is a good one. But when you get back to the end of Joseph's life, and you go back and you look at what happened with Joseph, Joseph didn't wait for other people to come to him and say, oh, we're so sorry we did all this. Joseph forgave his brothers before they ever said a word. And when you look back at Joseph's character, I really think he represents to us, really, Christ in the Old Testament. He represents that spirit of how do you treat people who have made mistakes? What do? Do we crush them? Do we like hold them down until they scream and say, I goofed all this, I made all this stuff, I did all these things wrong? What you see in Joseph is this willing spirit of realizing that I can forgive my brothers. And you wonder, like, how did he do it? His brothers couldn't even understand how he did it. But the reason Joseph could do it is because he was totally convinced, single-minded, not double-minded, that God was involved. James 1. This was the bottom framework of how, it's the foundation for how Bible characters react the right way in trials. When Joseph went through his trials and he had time to think about it, and all that time he was there in Egypt and he saw what God had done, he realized, I'm not going to blame the brothers for what they did, because God used it for good so that he could save people and keep us alive as we are at this day. But what was so tough for his brothers is they weren't like Joseph. They were still learning this process. They were still trying to understand how this works. And you can see in the brothers, as in contrast to Joseph, they really couldn't understand how he could forgive them. They're probably more like us. They were the kind of people that just couldn't even fathom the idea. If I was in Joseph's shoes, there's no way I could forgive my brothers. How can he do that? Because they hadn't caught on yet to the fact that God was totally involved in their life. And you find that out in Genesis 50, about 17 years after they came into Egypt, when Jacob finally died. Remember how they wouldn't even go to Joseph. They sent messengers to Joseph, and they made up this story in Genesis 50 at verse 15. When they saw that their father was dead, when Jacob was gone, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may repay us for all the evil which we did to him. After 17 years of being with this man, they still couldn't understand how he could possibly really forgive them. This is how bad we are, brothers and sisters. This is us. We're the brothers, really, more than we are Joseph. We don't understand mercy and forgiveness. It's a tough concept for us to get a hold of. Sometimes in our community, people, they exhort us and tell us that you really shouldn't even show it, that we ought to stand strong on judgments. But these poor people, they couldn't fathom how Joseph could really forgive them for what they'd done. So they make up a story and they say, all right, look, before Dad died, he said, make sure that you tell Joseph later on to please forgive you. As though they bring their dad into this and ask for their dad's help in this case to get him to forgive. And so Joseph then at that point, he just lays it all on the table and he says, look it, in verse 19, don't be afraid. For am I in the place of God? Am I going to make this kind of judgment on you? This isn't my job to take vengeance. It's not my job to judge you for what you did. As for you, Joseph very clearly states the fact you meant it for evil. So it's not like he's just looking at this with rosy glasses and didn't realize how bad their intent was. He admits the fact that, look, you did it. You had totally wrong intents. You were wrong all the way. But that's okay. God meant it for good. This is what Bible characters can do, Bible people, children of God, when they really believe that God's involved in their life. It will change the way you treat people. You don't have to take vengeance. You don't have to crush people into the ground because you understand that we're not in the place of God. God will judge those things. He will take the events and bring the events into those people's lives. He will help them understand their mistakes. And so Joseph says to them, look, don't be afraid. I'll provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. I really found that story is so critical for all of us because we tend to be like the brothers. All of us do. Very few of us are like a Joseph who really have that confidence that no matter what happens and what other people do to us, even with wrong intent, we can still forgive them because we understand that in all of this, God is in control and he is going to bring about good. I mean, we quote the passages all the time in Romans 8 that in everything, God works for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. If we really believe that, like James would say, if it isn't just a verse to quote, it's just not a doctrine to be, you know, stated. If you really believe it and you are a doer of that word, then you'll learn to live like Joseph and freely forgive these people that come to us having acknowledged that they've made a mistake and they're trying to move on and they want to go beyond it. I found this quote when we were doing this study on James. I really thought it's a very practical one because I'd never thought of it from that perspective before. But we tend to think of forgiveness as something that I've got control over this. And if Sue does something that's wrong in our relationship, now I've got some control over her and I can hold forgiveness against her. And I can just start to manipulate you a little bit and say, well, you've got to do this and you've got to do this before I can forgive you. We set up all these little parameters. And what was really good to look at is that forgiveness, it really isn't something that we do for other people. Forgiveness is something that we need to do for ourselves so that we can heal, we can get well, and we can move on. And until we see it that way, we look at it as a control issue. Like, I've got you now, and now you've got to do all these things for me before I will forgive you. And we do this in families, we do this in ecclesias, and it's just not right. It isn't the way it should be. And maybe we do that because, you know, we think we finally have control over something or control over a situation. And Bible characters like Joseph that understood God's involvement in their life, they don't act like that because they know God is in control, not me. And it's up to God to bring those circumstances into somebody's life. So in the rest of this chapter then, what he does is says, look, the doers of the word are going to have this active faith that's evident by their works of faith. This isn't a belief system. It's not a list of first principles like our statement of faith that we just all give an assent to and we're in the right club. That isn't how this works. We have a belief system, a central core of beliefs that are going to influence the decisions that we make, like Joseph, and we're going to change the way that we live. And he now brings up some Bible examples of this concept of how this would work. So he said, look, here's the situation in verse 14, or in verse 15. If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, now you can imagine this happening, that somebody's destitute, they show up, they're one of the poor, one of those poor that they look down on, and they come in the door over there and leave them in the back. They're one of those. So one of you says to them, you come up to this poor person and you talk to them and you say, oh, I hope you have a good day today. Depart in peace. God be with you. And I don't give you anything. What kind of a faith is that? Well, I see the need and I realize this fellow needs something. He's in need of the things that I have. God's given them to me, and I can share them with you. But instead, I just come along and give you a pat on the back and say, hope you have a good day today. God be with you. And what kind of faith is that? Well, what is that? That's a belief system, but it isn't changing your life at all. And you know, you don't give them anything that's needed for the body. What does it profit? That's like he said back in chapter 1. It's a useless faith if that's the kind of faith that we have. Thus, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. So if I'm like that, I have a dead faith. Maybe I belong to the Christadelphian community, and yeah, I might be in the right ecclesia, I'm in the right system, but it's not changing how I treat other people. It's a dead faith. But in verse 18, somebody else comes along in verse 18, and what this person does is this person will say, all right, you have faith and I have works. Now, this is one of these Bible passages that if you're not careful in our translations, you miss the fact that they threw the quotes in the wrong place. At least, I personally think they do. And if you go back and you look at it, you can see in some of our writings that it comes out a lot clearer if you just move the quotation marks. So the one of you back in verse 16, this would be one of these people that has this belief system. They think they're in the right club, therefore they are saved. That's back at verse 16. But in verse 18, now he's going back to this and he's contrasting it. But, he starts out with, this is going to be somebody different. So, but someone like James, or somebody who has an act of faith, they may say, all right, you've got faith and I've got works. Show me your faith without the works, and I will show you my faith by my works. See, it's all one quote right there, and the quotation mark should have been at the end of the verse. And what James is trying to get them to see is that, look, you claim you've got the right faith, you've got the belief system and everything, but you don't have the works. I'll show you by my works that I really have a belief system that can change the way I live. So that's just a suggestion there, that if you throw the quotes at the end of the verse there, the whole thing makes a lot more sense. And now what he's looking at is that by doing things, by looking at the events that we do in our life, of how involved are we in the ecclesia, how do we respond to what people do to us, how do we handle it when God throws things into our life, when we fall into various trials, how do we respond to those things? That's the kind of works that he's talking about, works that are generated as a result of faith, not works of law. See, this is where people mistakenly think James is against Paul. James isn't talking about works of law. He's not talking about checklists and legalistic things. He's not talking about doing the Bible readings and checking them off where you just go through systems of ritualistic behaviors. He's not even talking about the memorial service that we come there and we take the bread and the wine. He's talking about real life situations where you have to respond with your tongue, with not showing prejudice, with showing that you can respond the right way to people because you want to help out God's family. This is what he calls the works of faith. These are people that helped other people out or believed that God was going to do something in their life that was impossible for them to do. Now, can you see why he brings up Rahab in this situation? If you were looking for some Old Testament stories and you were trying to show people how folks that had this kind of faith did things that were way beyond the law. Now, Rahab didn't even have the law, and yet Rahab had a faith that was so active, she would put her own life on the line to save members of the community. This is the kind of works that James is actually going after. This is what he's really talking about in this case. Now, somebody asked me earlier about the passage about the demons, that when he goes on and he says, where is that, in verse 19, that you believe that there is one God. So he picks one of our first principles, and he said, all right, you got that one right? You believe that there was one God. You've got that doctrine correct. Well, you might think that's really good, because not everybody does. All the folks that believe in the Trinity, they don't really believe in that one God. So he said, you believe that there's one God? Sure, you do well. That's good that you believe that there's one God. But do you realize that even the demons can believe that and shudder? Even the demons can understand that and be afraid of that concept about the one God. But can that translate then into their life, into works of faith? And the answer is no. They can't respond with works of faith. God hasn't given them the mentality to do that, to respond in works of faith. All they can do is they believe a first principle and they can answer the question correctly, Like my autistic daughter can do that. She's 31 years old, and she's heard our Christadelphian beliefs over and over again. We could go through the doctrines, and we could say, well, what do you think about Jesus Christ? What do you think about the devil? What do you think about all these things? She can answer all the questions. But when it comes time to then implementing them into a way of life, well, that's a different story. See, and this is what James is trying to get us to see. You can have a belief system. You can have a bunch of doctrines, the Christadelphian doctrine, and you can go to the right place and belong to the right club, and it may not be changing your life at all. It might be a religion that he says is useless if it isn't turning you into a child of God. So those kind of things don't necessarily generate any works of faith. Because what works of faith will do is allow you to do things way beyond what you would normally have done because you totally believe God will take care of it. And so what James then finishes up with in this, at the end of chapter 2, is he finishes up with two Bible characters who did things, who acted in such a way that they put lives on the line because they really believed that God was going to take care of the situation, that he was in control. Therefore, they generated works of faith. So he looks at Abraham. And of course, we know with Abraham, and this would have been a good one for the Jews, because Abraham was their father, Father Abraham, that they look back to. We have Abraham as our father, they said in John chapter 8. We've never been in bondage to anybody because we're children of Abraham. So he goes back and looks at Abraham in verse 21 and says, look, wasn't our father Abraham justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? You see that his faith was working together with his works. And by works, faith was made perfect. And the scripture was fulfilled that Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So way back years ago, he looked up in the sky and God said, I'm going to make your descendants like those stars. And he believed God would do it. But then years later, when it came time to put that belief system to test, was it just a bunch of words? Or do you really believe that, and you're going to listen to me, and you're going to follow my directions, and I want you to take your son Isaac, your only son whom you love, even though he really wasn't his only son, but he wanted him represented in the Bible as God's only begotten son. He says, you're going to take your son, and you're going to go through what I'm going to do. You're going to take your son, and you're going to offer him up. And so Abraham went through that. Now, we know in Hebrews 11, the reason this is such an important event is because Abraham totally was convinced and believed in God's promise that through Isaac, the seed would be blessed and all those stars would come. Therefore, he totally was convinced that if he killed Isaac, God was going to resurrect him from the dead right there. That's the belief system that he had. He totally trusted that God would take care of it. And this is the kind of faith that James is after. People whose works then are generated by faith, not works of law. This is why Paul could write in Galatians and say, by works of law, no flesh will be justified. That's not against James. He's saying those are different kinds of works. Those are people going through checklists and ritualistic offerings and sacrifices and feast days and foods, clean and unclean and all that kind of stuff. By works of law, nobody is going to be justified. But by works of faith, that's a different story. These are things which show by our works that we really have the faith that will justify us. This is the kind of thing that we're really after in our lives and in our family life. John Thomas, I guess, had made a quote. It took me a while to figure out where it was because John Carter picked it up. And he said that Abraham the sinner was justified by faith. Abraham the saint was justified by works. And it's in John Carter's book, and if you ever look through that on Romans, I wondered, like, where in the world did he get it from? Because I went through and searched Lebronics, and I couldn't find it anywhere until I finally just looked for certain phrases, like Abraham the sinner or something like that. If you're ever looking for that and wondering where it comes from, it's in the Christadelphian magazine back in 1904, and it actually isn't a real quote. It's like a paraphrase of a whole long section there. And what John Carter does is he just like takes the gist of it and throws it out there. That John Thomas had suggested that what God did was when Abraham was a sinner, Abraham the sinner was justified by faith. But then once he was in the family, Abraham the saint then was justified by works, but not works of law. It's works of faith. And that's the key to understanding the difference between James and Paul. Paul's looking at it from a perspective of going after the Jews and condemning them for thinking that their works of law would ever justify them. James, on the other hand, is taking some of these Jews and saying, if you really have a belief system that will change your life, then the works of faith, you won't be able to stop them. They're just going to flow. And so as James says here, that Abraham was called the friend of God. And you can actually go back and find that twice in the Old Testament he's referred to that way. In 2 Chronicles 20, he talks about Abraham, your friend. And also in Isaiah 41, he was referred to as the descendants of Abraham, my friend. I actually think that comes from Genesis 18. You remember when we looked at the story yesterday of how the three angels got together and they talked to one another and they said, what do you think? Should we tell Abraham what we're going to do? What do you think we should do? Good idea? Yeah. So they said, all right, we should. Now, why would they do that? Because like Jesus said in John, he said that friends don't hide from each other what they're doing. Because you are my friends. And that's the way he treated them. Abraham was God's friend because they were working together, and you don't hide from your friends what you're doing. And the angels went down there and talked to Abraham. So that's why he's probably called the friend of God. And James's point is then that man is justified by faith, not just by works. If you're ever looking for an example of how to try to show this and explain it to other people, folks that we run into contact with in our contacts of trying to help folks understand how you can be justified by works and yet we're still saved by faith. I really think in the Old Testament that probably the whole story of Israel coming in and taking the land is like one of those good places to go as an historical context to explain the concept of how we're saved by faith and justified by works. Because when Joshua took the people in the land, and when they took Jericho and went through all the land and they finally took the land, God made it clear in Deuteronomy he was giving them the land. If you ever do any Bible coloring on that, you can just see over and over again he keeps saying, the land which I have given you, the land which I have given you. You're never going to earn this thing, and there's nothing you could ever do to deserve it. It's a gift. It's grace. This was what God was trying to illustrate when he brought the community into the land. But they still had to follow God's directions. They still had to believe as he made them walk around Jericho 7 days, walk around the city and believe that by doing what God had asked them to do, the walls of the city would fall and that they would take the city. These are what we call works of faith. They're not ritualistic works of law. These are things that we do because God says this is the right thing to do, and we do it because we trust that he will then win the victory. And you can see that with Joshua when he ended up taking the land. Now, the other one that he brings up at the end of James chapter 2 is Rahab. And I think these are probably good examples. When you look back in James 2, he really has three people in mind. We looked yesterday how he looked at adultery and murder and was really sort of thinking of David at that point. So you've got King David, and then you've got Abraham, their father, and now we have a woman. And I think what James has done is he lays out these three different examples to try to cover all the cases in life. I mean, who could do anything worse than David had done, where you commit adultery and you commit murder? And then he looks at their father Abraham, that they would look back to as their champion of faith, and that the man who was the father of the whole community. And now he picks a Gentile lady, and it illustrates the fact that this is the same principle at work. So by picking three different characters like that, he's like trying to cover the gamut so that they realize this is just a general principle and it applies to everybody in the family of God. So he looks back at Rahab at the end of this chapter and he says in verse 25 that Rahab the harlot. Now see, this is good. He says Rahab the harlot. This is say Rahab. It's Rahab the harlot. So here's a woman who is living in prostitution. She's a Gentile. She's not part of the Jewish community. And she's still justified by works of faith. This is how it works for everybody. She was justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way. That these are the kind of things that faith will generate in people. That faith will help us to do things that are way beyond what law could ever do. You're not doing it because there's some law that says specifically you got to do this thing. It's because you're trying to live like a child of God and treat people the right way. And so you put your own life on the line in order to save the people of God and help them in God's project. This is what works of faith will do for people. And so Rahab would have been a good extreme case way out there, so that if this is the case with Rahab, I mean, who's further out than that? a prostitute who's not part of the community, and she's living over there in Jericho, and ends up being saved by and justified by works of law, by works of faith in this case. So those are really the three that he picks, David and Abraham and Rahab. And I really believe that James picks them for very specific reasons, because they illustrated all of these principles from somewhat extreme cases for the Jewish mind. And so he finishes up with this idea that so faith without works is dead also. And, you know, brothers and sisters, for all of us, when we go home and young people, you want to make sure that you never are satisfied with just having a Christadelphian church that you go to. This is not about a club. It's not about being in the right religion. It's about having a way of life that you learn to live like God, like God's children. This is what it's all about, that we have a faith that's very active and a faith that then helps other people. So that's pretty much it for chapter 2. Now, chapter 3, maybe 3 is a little bit more direct, because he starts out with this example of the tongue in James chapter 3. And what he's going to do now is look at something he had already started. Where had he brought up the tongue before? Remember where that was? Where did he bring up the part about the tongue? This is where you have to think. Where did he mention the tongue before? Chapter 1 and verse 26. All right, so this isn't new. This is something he's already thrown out there. Now, you remember what he said back in chapter 1 at verse 26? He said, if anyone among you thinks he is religious, so you think, yeah, I'm religious. I got my Bible, do my Bible readings, go to meeting, maybe I've been baptized. I take the emblems, the bread and the wine. If anybody thinks that you're religious, but does not bridle his tongue, he deceives his own heart, and this one's religion is useless. Now, that's critical in James's mind. This is a big one, the tongue. Because you think back in families and ecclesial life, look at how often people have said things in ecclesial life, or said things at ranging meetings, said things at ecclesial business meetings, or said things in situations where we blew up and we didn't bridle our tongue. And James's warning is that if that's the case, then our tongue is really revealing what's really here in the heart. And it's a warning to us that if we think we've had a religion that's really powerful and we think we've been saved, if it doesn't have the power to control our tongue, it's not doing what God had intended. The power of the truth should be such that the influence of the implanted word in our minds should be changing how we talk to each other and how we react in situations. It's got to control us. This is not optional when James brings this up. This isn't like, well, maybe this will happen to some people. James said, if it doesn't work, your religion is useless. And now he's going to go on and expand in chapter 3 a whole section here about how your tongue gives away what's really in your heart. And I think this is very serious, brothers and sisters. You know, when you look at family relationships, we can come here to a Bible school and we can all talk really nice to each other and treat each other really well. I mean, just face it, Sue and I are away from home. We could be really good to each other while we're here, put on a good show. I could hold her hand and treat her really nice and say, what can I do for you, dear? Anything you'd like to eat? And what can I get you? Any slippers or whatever? And put on a real good show while we're here. And then as soon as we leave this place, things go right back to normal. What's the matter with you? And then I can just talk to her like that and treat her. Brothers and sisters, this happens in Christadelphian families. These things ought not to be so. You just read that. This is not the way it's supposed to work. The power of the truth, the influence of the implanted word, a faith that generates works of love, doesn't let us do that. If I ever did do that to Sue, that I should hate myself. I don't need her to tell me I'm wrong. I should look in the mirror and walk away with the mirror test and realize that, wow, I've got a problem. I've got to do something different. I need to do something more than what I'm doing right now, because it's not controlling my tongue. And you know, I think James picks good things here. He picks things like prejudice. He picks things like the tongue, because they're really clear. They're laid out on the table, really open for us to see. And although you might not see it while we're here at Bible school, because you really have no idea how I really treat Sue at home, you don't know. She does. She can tell you. But we all know what happens in our own families. When we go home next week and we're just there with our families, our husbands and our wives and our children, and you guys with mom and dad, it works for you too. How do you respond to mom and dad? What happens when things don't go well? Do you just blow up like other kids and out in the world? And I've seen that at school. I used to be at parent-teacher conferences, and kids would come in with their mom, and all of a sudden they'd have to face the reality of, what's your grade in this class? You haven't been doing your homework? And mom would be, you know, talking to a child like that. And I've seen children just get right up and scream back at their parents. It's all your fault because you didn't provide time, and you take us off to all these places. And people are really nasty to each other. They're really unkind. And this is not what the truth is supposed to do. If we have a truth, if we really have a belief system that affects your life, it will have the power to control your tongue. It will give you the ability to do something that you can't do yourself. So this is basically what James goes after right here. So in chapter 3, he starts off with this little section right there. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. So for those of you that don't have to get up and teach Sunday school and teach in your ecclesia, and all of you who don't have to do those things, consider that a great joy, because those of us who get up and tell you what you should be doing and what I should be doing, we are in the stricter judgment class. I can't get up and tell you all these things and then go home and not apply them. We're going to be held to a higher level of accountability, because the teachers, they remind everybody else all the time, and they should certainly remind themselves. So when we're leading Bible classes and we're doing all those things in our community, we are now being exposed to the influence of the Word. And when we explain that to other people as teachers, or when we do this in Sunday school, you look at all your kids in Sunday school, those of you that are Sunday school teachers, look at how they look up to you. Or those of you that teach at CHS, when you teach at the school, those children, they look up to you as an example. And they expect you to be providing them with an example of the character of Christ. And so we do get held to a higher standard because we put ourselves before people. But James warns us in verse 2, for we all stumble in many things. Or as the RSV says there, we all make many mistakes. So let's not pretend that we're something that we really aren't. When we look in the mirror and we do the mirror test, we realize that we make mistakes. Everybody does. We all stumble. Now, he already had pointed out back in chapter 2 that if you stumble in one point of the law, you're held guilty of all of the condemnation of the law. So you certainly wouldn't want to go back to that system. But what you've got to do is realistically understand that, look, we do make some mistakes. And if we don't make mistakes, we'd be some kind of perfect man that we really aren't. And these are all areas that we have to work on. So if anyone does not stumble in a word, he says he's a perfect man, able also to bridle his whole body. And then he goes on to some specific examples of this issue about how this would work, about how you can look at some specific cases of whether you can bridle the body or control your body. And the tongue is probably the best one. So he goes on to looking at the idea of putting bits in a horse's mouth. You got horses over here in Australia? You got horses, right? Anybody ever put a bit in a horse's mouth? Anybody actually done that? Yes, somebody's done that, right? And what happens when you put the bit in the mouth? It pulls back there on their mouth, and then when you pull on the reins, what happens? What are you doing? You sort of like yanking and making it very uncomfortable for the horse, but you can use that little bit right there. That little guy right there can control that whole big horse. So we use a little bit like that in order to control it, and they will then obey us. So he says, look at people that are good at this, they can put a bit in somebody's mouth, and people in James's day would have known this. They put that in there, and they can use that little thing to control the whole horse, big, powerful horses. And he goes on and says that not only is that true with bits, but look also at your ships. You see those big ships that are out there in your ocean right now. We're over on the other side of the coast, over by Sydney and Wollongong. We see all those ships lined up that are coming in with coal and iron ore and stuff like that. They have these huge ships that are out there. Well, look at that big giant ship right there. When it's out there working, when it's out there in the water and it's rolling along, it's controlled by that little rudder back there. By just spinning that little rudder, you know, in just little bits, you can actually turn that entire whole ship. And all it takes is that little rudder back there to control that whole ship. When we were over in Chicago, Sue and I, when we were in Chicago one time, and there's a museum over in Chicago where the United States has a U-boat that was captured in World War II. It's the U-505 boat. This is one of these huge, long submarines that the Germans had been using. And they let you go in and have a look at the submarine. You can go in that in the Chicago Science Museum over there. And what we did is, at the time, I was working on some stuff on James, so I had her sit at the back there. That's actually the rudders at the back of the U-boat. So that huge, long submarine is controlled by two rudders back here, and that's what will allow that thing to actually steer out there in the water. So James's point is that, look it, we can control horses, we can control boats, we can control all kinds of animals that are out there. We can tame all these different things, but you can't control your tongue. You can't do it. Now, some of us read that, and then we think, there we go, see, I can't control it. And we just walk away and think, there, we're all set, right? James said it, you can't control the tongue. So why do you expect me to control my tongue? But that isn't James's point. His point is that I can't control my tongue, but the influence of the implanted word, it will control your tongue if it's really there. So he doesn't let us squeeze out of that with some kind of an excuse that, I just can't control it. I was born this way. This is the way God made me. It's easier for you to control your tongue than it is for me. Those aren't excuses we can throw at each other, brothers and sisters. Don't ever say that to your spouse, that, it's easier for you than it is for me. We're all in this together. Everybody is under the same operating principle of the Spirit of God. And so James's point is that, look at the tongue. Just like those little rudders, just like those little things back there on the boats, the tongue is just like that. It's a little member, but look at how it can control big things, and look at the damage it can do. And I know most of you have probably seen that. I don't know about over here. You have fires over here, don't you? We have like controlled burns. When we were over in Sydney and Wollongong, we saw a few controlled burns going on over there because you don't want these wild forest fires. We have wild forest fires in California every so often where somebody will throw a cigarette out the window and it'll start some huge area on fire. Those are nasty. When you have the dry areas, you get these big old forest fires. That whole forest fire all starts from that little guy right there, that little match. And James's point is that all it takes is an ecclesial business meeting for one person to throw out there with their tongue some little thing, and we start this huge fire burning in the ecclesia. And those kind of things shouldn't happen, as he's going to say in this chapter. Don't let that be so. Because the power of the implanted word is supposed to control what we say. This is the way it should work. This is like having works of faith, and we learn to control that tongue. So James goes on and he says, look at it. The tongue is a fire, and it's the spokesman for your heart. That's how he sees it. When we say things and they finally come out of our mouth, and we wish sometimes we could just put our hand over it and take it back. So it's almost like pushing the button when you do send on an email, and then once in a while after you push that send, you wonder, is there a way of retrieving that? And you wish you could get it back sometimes. Well, too late. And once it comes out of our mouth and we say it, what it shows everybody else and the angels that are there with us and God and the Lord Jesus Christ is that's what's really down here in me. This is what I really believe. This is how I really think. And the tongue gives us away. And it so easily can start up all these ecclesial fires, family fires, and it can happen from anybody. It can happen from moms to dads, dads to moms. It can happen from moms and dads to kids. It can happen from kids up to parents. We all have to work on this. This is a huge area of living as a member of God's family, learning to control our tongues. That's why James puts it in here and spends a half a chapter on it, because it was such a critical issue, and it's the second time that he's even brought it up. So the tongue, what it can do, it can boast these great things. But what it's doing when it boasts those great things, like he says in here, he calls it in verse 6, the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. Now, back in Romans 12, when Paul was dealing with the parts of the body, when he says that it was so placed in our body, God put our mouth right there in the center of our face. He put it there for a reason. And it ends up being that out of this area, right in the central part of our bodies, that's where we finally reveal what is really down here in our hearts, or what's really up here in our brains. And the tongue, when you're looking at somebody and you're getting a facial connection with somebody, right out of their mouth then, sometimes things come out that set on these nasty fires. And what it does, it simply reveals the pride that we have. It reveals what's really there in our heart. It comes out at times when we're jealous. It comes out at times when we're upset, where we feel like we have to take vengeance instead of God. Or it comes out at times when we're frustrated at events that have happened in our life. Now you can look at Job and look at the story with his three friends and how their tongues gave them away when they said what they did with each other. And it revealed what was really there in our hearts. So God has put your tongue there, and he's put it there in the center of your face, and he's put it there for a reason, that it can either be a positive thing in helping the body, or it can be a very negative thing, but either way, that central part of our body gives us away as to what's really down there in our heart. And it can be stimulated and fueled by the garbage and the waste that's out there. As James would go on to say there, for every kind of beast and every bird and reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. So that's true, that we can tame all these different things. When I was over in Dubai, we saw people that could tame falcons, and they could train falcons to go out and hunt for them. You've probably seen cases of people that can tame lions, things that we would normally be totally spooked out and scared by. We have people that can tame snakes, even your wild snakes over here with all their poison in them. There are people that can actually tame snakes, and they can charm them. And we have people that can train these giant orca whales, those killer whales, and go out and swim with them. So as humans, we can do all this kind of stuff of taming all these creatures and controlling boats and all these things that we do, but the tongue, it's just an unruly and restless evil. He says it's like full of deadly poison. And those words that he uses in this section here are really words that are, in the Greek at least, that are very potent with meaning, because they're words that are used, like the word tame is used of legion back in Mark 5 at verse 4. The word unruly is the one that he had earlier translated unstable in chapter 1, that the double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. And the poison will be picked up in James 5 again in verse 3 about the corrosion of the gold and the silver. So he's trying to pick up examples of showing us how wild this tongue really is. And his point is simply that you can't control it. So in verse 8, he spells it right out. But no one can tame his tongue. It's an unruly evil full of deadly poison. And he goes on that with it we bless our God and our Father, and with it we curse men. We have been made in the similitude of God. So look at what we do with our tongues. We can use them in positive ways. We use them in negative ways. And the sad thing is, in ecclesial life today and in family life, there's plenty of ways to use our tongues in negative ways. And we can do it today on the sly. That's what's interesting to me. We can get on cell phones today and we can sneak things around, and for some reason we just don't think it's really as bad as saying the same thing to somebody in person. We go around and we got the whispering that goes on in ecclesial life, or what we call the Christadelphian grapevine sometimes, where things get passed around in the grapevine of Christadelphia. We have text messaging today. We have emailing going on today. We have all kinds of ways today that we can send information out from us, and it may not be a positive thing that's helping brethren and sisters. And James's point is simply that if the truth is impacting our lives, brethren and sisters, we'll think twice before we hit send. We'll think twice before we just say something that could destroy another person or upset the ecclesia. And instead, we'll learn to control it. Because nobody can tame the tongue. You can't do it. Any more than Abraham could resurrect Isaac from the dead. But if you have a faith that's active, if you have a belief system that really believes God is operating in your life, then you would put Isaac to death, believing that God would resurrect him, and you will believe that the Bible will change what you do, and it will change the way you talk, the way you treat other people, and his word can do that. And that's why we spend so much time on reading the word, listening to the word. It doesn't have to be a class like this. It could be simply reading the Bible in your home. It could be meditating upon the Bible in your home, just thinking about things, things of God. It could be listening to classes in your home. Some of you listen to CDs and tapes of the Bible. You get in the car and you put the Bible on instead of all the music of this world. Those are the things that help our mind get into a frame of mind to where we can respond properly to people like God would have us do, and learn to live as children of God. I remember when we were over at the Shippensburg Bible School one year in Canada, over in the United States, and Harry Tennant happened to be there, and he was sitting there. What we did at Shippensburg is we would split up into groups in the afternoon for doing the Bible readings. They called it family Bible reading time. And so what you would do is take your whole Bible school at Shippensburg. They have like 500 and some people at that school. And so if you just all came to an auditorium to do the Bible readings, it would be like this huge big room, and one person would get up and read the Bible, and probably half of the audience wouldn't even be paying attention. They'd be half asleep or whatever. So what they did is they split up into little groups. And they split up into groups of like 20, 25 people and had Bible readings in all different areas over the college during a period from like 5:15 in the afternoon before 6 to 6 o'clock, right before dinner. And we would get together in these little groups and do the Bible readings. And we'd read around, like they call them family Bible readings, like you would at your house. And I remember when we were at the school that year, I don't know, do you remember that, Sue? We were doing that when Harry was in our Bible readings group. And he got up and he told our group, he said, "This is the most important thing you do the entire week. And he tried to explain to the parents it was more important than the classes, it was more important than the kids' activities, that the Bible reading time, in his opinion, was the thing that would have the greatest impact upon our children of anything we ever do. More important than Sunday school, than meeting, than all of it, because you do it every day, you do it in your family house, in your nuclear family, just like we were doing there at the school, and it's every day then God has an opportunity to work in your children's lives. So it was an interesting concept of what he tried to do is just to encourage everybody that what they had started that week at Bible school, make sure you take that habit home with you and continue it on for the rest of the year. So James's point simply is that, no, we can't tame the tongue, but the Word of God can certainly tame it, and it can change the way we react. Because with the same tongue we bless God, and with that same tongue we curse men that are created in God's image. And you wonder, like, how can you do that? How can we bless God and then look at a brother or sister who for whom Christ died, and we curse them and we say things to them that we shouldn't say? We do it to our spouse. We do it to our ecclesial members. And if we really did believe that those people were members of God's family, and we go to say something to another person in ecclesial life and we're ready to react in a negative way, and we look at them and we realize, wow, their angel is sitting there right there listening to everything I say, and so is mine. And the two angels are going to end up having a discussion after I say this thing that upsets you, and they're going to have to try to figure out, what are we going to do in this person's life to try to correct this so this doesn't happen again? And if we learn to raise our level of thinking higher to what the implanted Word is trying to do, we won't curse men that are made in God's image like that. So although we can try to keep our mouths shut, and we could go away from this camp and say, well, I'm going to do it, it isn't going to happen, brethren and sisters, unless we're receiving the implanted Word. We've got to give God's Word some time to operate on our minds. It's God that will change our life, not me. It's not about me going home and saying, well, I'm going to do this. What we do instead is we get involved in the ecclesia. We learn to love our brothers and sisters. We read God's Word and take it into our life. And that changes us over time. And see, that's the difference between the legalistic approach and the approach where you let faith generated by love change what we end up doing in our lives. Because what happens with our poor old tongues is they simply reveal what's in our hearts, and they simply show everybody what we were really thinking. And as James says there at the end right there, my brethren, these things ought not to be so. I mean, that's one of those things that you highlight in your Bible, you color it in, and it stands out in the mirror test. We look at that in the mirror test. You can't walk away from this and just think, well, this isn't going to change the way I live. He doesn't let us weasel out of it. He says at the end here, these things ought not to be so. And so this is a test. This is a barometer for us. Watch what we say over the next month or so. How do we respond to brothers and sisters? What happens when things go bad and something happens that was out of our control and it didn't go the way we wanted? What happens when we're driving along on the road and somebody cuts us off? Are we the kind of person who just wants to yell and scream at them from our car? Are we the kind of person that learns to let the implanted Word change the way that we live, change the way that we act and we treat other people, and we respond like a Joseph? That, yeah, oh, that guy that put in there, maybe he did. Maybe he really wanted to cut me off and he really had bad intentions and all that. But you know what? Maybe the angels are trying to stop me from going down a pathway that will lead me into an accident. And they're trying to slow me down. Maybe they're trying to talk to me today to try to get me to think about higher things instead of just what I was thinking about in my car. This is what Bible characters do. They receive with meekness the implanted Word. They let it grow in their lives. And it changes the way they talk to one another. So we'll probably leave it there for today at that part of chapter 3. We'll finish up the last little section there tomorrow about the difference in the wisdom, and hopefully pick up chapter 4, get us back on track so we can hopefully have time for 5 on Friday. Thanks very much. It's all yours, Bobby.